If it's 6 p.m. on a Thursday, that means it's time for Lehigh Valley Discourse here on WDIY 88.1 FM, WDIY.org, and our WDIY app. And we start off with Perspectives with John Pierce. Our topic this evening is, I'm going to call it Poor Mother Earth, and we'll see where we go with this conversation. It's going to be fun, I will promise you that, because my guest is Dr. Dork Sahagian, professor of earth and environmental science at Lehigh University. And Dr. Sahagian, you had to walk about two blocks to come over to our studios, right?
Yes, it was a long way, but I made it.
He's a survivor. His research interests include tectonics, sea level, and the environmental impacts of human activities. So let's start off with tectonic. I've heard of tectonic plates. Mm-hmm. So what is tectonics exactly?
Well, it's the motion of the tectonic plates, which is the continents and the ocean lithosphere that they're embedded in, around the Earth, driven by a few things, including the negative buoyancy of the subducting slabs of the ocean going down into the ocean lithosphere, going down into the mantle, and by surface tractions, and by ridge push forces at the mid-ocean ridge. And they move all around, and they make mountains, and they make ridges, and they make oceans. And where the downgoing slabs go into the mantle, they generate all kinds of melt that makes wonderful volcanoes. And these volcanoes are of a particular interest of mine because we're still trying to figure out just how and why does they erupt.
Ooh, all right. So what you're saying is there is a lot of activity going on below the surface of the Earth while we're walking around thinking everything's stable.
Yeah, there's nothing stable on the Earth. It's pretty much a very active, dynamic planet.
Underneath.
Underneath and on the surface.
And on the surface.
And up where we are.
We'll get to it.
Things moving around on the here, too.
Dr. Sahagian served as author and reviewer for the various assessment reports of the Nobel Prize-winning Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And he recently wrote a new book for the 21st century that realizes that students have all the facts and figures of the internet in their pockets, but need the intellectual tools to understand it all. It is titled A User's Guide for Planet Earth, Fundamentals of Environmental Science. What I love about your approach is that you're a scientist speaking to non-scientists, right?
Yes, and as a scientific community, we've been notoriously bad at that. We've been really miserable in communicating with the general public, with policymakers, and sadly, in many cases, with our students. But we're becoming much better at that as our pedagogical approaches improve. But this book I wrote because the books that I had been assigning in my big introductory class in environmental science were long, heavy, verbose, diluted with lots of storytelling, and $200. And they're out of date by the middle of the semester. So I said, well, we need to do something a little bit more dynamic than that. Just the science, just understanding how the environment works so that the students kind of have a feeling, non-majors now, so when a business student goes and gets a job with some big company or something, they understand what the impacts are of what the company does and how the environmental changes around the world are impacting the company's business. And without understanding how the environment works, they'll be working blind.
So Dr. Sahagian's work integrates disparate disciplines in geology, environmental science, technology, policy, and the myriad interactions between people and the environment. What does it mean when we say policy?
Policy, well,
is that governmental policy?
Yes, it's and very often it's industrial policy and community policy, but it's the kind of thing that, you know, some things only work and are only good if everybody does it. And the only way to get everybody to do it is to make a policy. Here's how we shall behave such that is better for everyone. That way you avoid the two prisoner problem,
What's the two prisoner problem?
Well, it's better for one person to rat out the other, or it's better for one person to abuse the resources, right? And the other one gets nothing. But it's better for both if neither of them abuse the resources, and then they have it sustainably forever. And better for the prisoners if neither one rats out the other one, right? It's a famous problem. So this is how we avoid the tragedy of the commons, which is a basic idea where we have a common resource for all to use. Fine. But if everyone uses it without taking care of it, it goes away for everyone. Then you need a policy to control how it's used so it can be done sustainably.
Dr. Sahagian's bachelor's degree is from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, his master's degree from Rutgers, and PhD from the University of Chicago. So Dr. Sahagian, professor of Earth and Environmental Science at Lehigh University, is my guest here on Perspectives. We are talking about the Earth because that's his specialty. And my first question for you, are humans the cause of climate change? Do you believe there is climate change? Let's go more basic.
Well, now, these things are not really a question of belief. It's a question of observation, interpretation, and conclusion. That's the meaning of science. And absolutely, humans are causing climate change on a background of very slow and gradual natural climate change. There are reasons for climate to change over hundreds of thousands of years. Every 100,000 years, we have a glacial and interglacial cycle. This is caused by orbital variations of the Earth around the sun. This much we know. This is very slow. But very rapidly, since the Industrial Revolution, we started burning fossil fuels and hugely overpopulating the planet, thereby using land, meaning cutting down trees and tearing up grasslands in order to plant crops. Since that time, we've introduced a big shot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, which has quickly, much more quickly than in the past, warmed the climate and brought us to a situation in which atmospheric chemistry is very much out of equilibrium with ocean temperature, ocean circulation, atmospheric circulation, biome distribution of where the forests and grasslands and things are. So we're doing a really cool experiment with the planet. Like, let's change the way we balance the radiation between the planet and the sun and see what happens.
Uh-oh. Doesn't sound like a good outcome here.
Oh, it's fun as anything. Scientists live for this kind of stuff. Let's do an experiment. It would be convenient, though, if we didn't have to live on this experimental planet.
Yes, indeed. So when we say, are humans the cause of climate change, generally we think of our own century, and we think of driving cars and having smokestacks on buildings and whatnot. You're saying this goes way back to the beginning, at least, there's a big change, the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
Sure, that's when it started. But it started slow and has been accelerating ever since and is still accelerating.
So we go into the 18th century for this?
Yeah, you can go into the mid to late 18th century. And we started, you know, burning coal and oil. First commercial oil well was right here in Pennsylvania, right? And in you know, western Pennsylvania. So we started burning the fossil fuels to find really rapid, concentrated energy conveniently packaged in petroleum, coal, or natural gas. And this took hundreds of millions of years, well, tens at least, but usually 100 or a couple hundred million years to form. And it all comes from solar energy ultimately, but geologic processes condense this into a very convenient energy source that now we can burn like a flash in the pan, burning 100 million years worth of stuff in a century.
100 million years. Oh. Well, Dr. Sahagian, you have said that to bring us up to our current situation and looking a little toward the future, wet areas of the Earth are getting wetter and dry areas drier. Is there anything we can do about this?
Well, there's two things we can do, and this is all part of the climate change milieu of the planet. The projections and the observations already are that areas that already have abundant rainfall will get more. Areas that have not quite enough will get less. And you can see this in areas like Spain and the Sahel, whereas rampant desertification is going on because things are drying up. They're already dry and getting drier. You won't see much difference in the middle of Arabia or the Sahara because it's already bone dry.
Right.
But in the places that are marginal are becoming worse in terms of growing crops and maintaining ecosystems. Meanwhile, wet places, including Pennsylvania, which is a wet place, get wetter, which can lead to more flooding, which is, of course, another problem. Now, what can we do? Well, things we can do fall in two categories in general in terms of dealing with climate change. One is mitigation. Mitigation is stopping bad things from happening. Okay, prevent it from happening, and we can do that by stopping burning fossil fuels, replanting forests, finding ways to capture and store carbon out of the atmosphere, put it into geologic formations or at least the deep ocean. There's things we can do to reverse climate change or stop it and then reverse it. So that's mitigation. Hard to get people to agree to do that, but that's the mitigation. So, stop bad things from happening. The other side of that is, okay, some things are going to happen anyway, even if we try to stop it. And if we don't try to stop it, even more will happen. So we'd better learn how to deal with it, and that's adaptation. So we can adapt to the new world, how it's going to be. And it's not going to look like the old one. So any ideas we had of how things are running, how things will work, we have to rethink because it's going to be a different planet in the next coming centuries. So we got to plan ahead for that. For example, a lot of the cities in the world are on the coasts.
Yes,
sea level's
indeed.
Rising.
Right.
Right? Well, they better move. You can't protect them against sea level. You can make a little dam around them. Not really. It won't work.
So we're thinking of places like Miami.
Oh, yeah.
New Orleans.
Miami. New Orleans is already below sea level.
Yes.
And sinking and subsiding at the same time as sea level is rising. And at the same time, they took out all the mangrove swamps that were protecting from coastal storm surge. So they get it. They'll see more floods.
Right. I'm also thinking of Italy.
Mm-hmm. Venice. I was recently in Venice, and it's remarkable there. I was there at a relatively dry time, so I was able to walk on the paved surface of the ground of the city. However, I was walking past all these 2.5 foot, 3 feet high platforms that they put together to make walking paths for when the water's high. So you can walk around the city on top of these platforms, because otherwise you'd have to wear fishing waders.
Whoa.
You know, to go anywhere in the city.
Yes, and I think it's a fact that city is sinking a couple of inches a century or something like that.
Yep.
And it sounds like, well, we won't be around here when it actually is underwater. But our children, our grandchildren.
Yeah, that's the intergenerational equity issue, right? You know, what should we do now that benefits us in a way that will not prevent our grandchildren from being benefited?
Right.
You know, we don't want to hurt them, but some people just care about what's happening right now.
Well, as you know, by now, dear listeners, we are talking about the Earth and what's happening to the Earth and how much we are involved in, we as human beings are involved in the future here, and what can we do about it, because climate change is a fact. And that's what Dr. Sahagian from Lehigh University is telling us. It's a scientific truth. Time for us to take a break, so hang in there, and we will be back, and we hope with some good news here on Perspectives, and we'll be back in a moment.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar every Thursday from 7 to 9 here on WDIY.
And we're back with Dr. Dork Sahagian of Lehigh University. We're talking about the planet that we live on and what's happening to it. And one thing that I learned on a cruise that my wife and I took to Alaska, and we were out there on the waters and could hear glaciers making their noises as they cracked and whatnot. And the guide said, there's always movement going on under the earth, under what we perceive as, what do we call it, the crust of the earth? Or?
Well, there's the crust is embedded in the lithosphere, yeah, the crust is the top, right.
Right.
You know, but if you're standing on a glacier, you think that the glacier is the ground.
Right.
It's not.
And I had never thought about that and thinking about how the earth is in movement all the time underneath us. So let's go to a question of, are humans responsible for climate change? Now, usually I've heard the answer partially, but not totally. Is that your answer too?
Well, it depends on the climate change you're talking about. If you're talking about climate change of the 21st century, it's almost completely. So it's not just partially, it's not even mostly, it's almost completely. The rate of change, the natural rate of change of climate at this point is trivial compared to what we're doing anthropogenically. And to look at that, first you have to look around and look and see, you know, there's five questions to answer in sequence when you look at this. One is climate changing at all? Well, we have instrumented records and measurements very clear for the past more than 100 years that, yes, the climate is changing. We can make observations. And not only is the climate changing in terms of global temperatures, sea surface temperatures, ice cover and seasonality, all of the phenology is the coming and going of the seasons of the living plants and animals. And all these things are changing. So clearly it's happening. But until you recognize that, there's no sense going on to answer the next question, are humans responsible?
Yes.
Right? And here's where the simple science comes in of the greenhouse effect in the atmosphere, where the solar radiation comes down chiefly in the visible, to which the atmosphere is transparent. Otherwise, we couldn't see each other. And outgoing radiation from the Earth is in the infrared, much cooler, of course, than the sun, and that's in the infrared. And any gaseous molecule in the atmosphere of more than two atoms is a greenhouse gas because it absorbs the infrared radiation at various wavelengths. And these include CO2, of course, is what we've been mostly emitting out of fossil fuels, but also water vapor, by the way, very strong greenhouse gas, an important one, methane, which is much, much stronger greenhouse gas, and various other gases that have more than two atoms in a molecule. So yes, this is simple atmospheric physics, and we know that we are warming the planet by putting more greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That's simple. Okay, fine, you recognize that. Now you say, well, is that a bad thing? Some people don't like winter. They want it to be warmer. Well, throughout human history, at least, any time there's been a change in the environment, it has been detrimental to society that suffered it. And you can look at various societies that have collapsed and civilizations that have collapsed during various times of climate change. Over the past 10,000 years or so, we've had a very stable climate. So human civilization evolved with a very steady, stable climate. So as a species, we are very conservative. We want things to stay just the same.
Yes.
Right? We're not used to something different. So it's going to be very difficult when things get different, and we're making it different. So in a sense, you know, we're being liberal with the way we treat the planet rather than conserving the way things have always been, right? So change is kind of bad in general, despite you not wanting to shovel snow. Okay, it's bad. Is there anything we can do about it? The next question, right? And the good news is it's not too late. If we stop fossil fuel burning very soon, meaning in the next couple of decades, and try to restore some of the forests and try to restore the carbon that is sequestered in the crust and in the ocean in various ways, and there's a number of ways to do that, right? We can halt and reverse climate change. We can do that. And finally, the question, we can do all that, but is it worth it financially, right? Well, now you have to look at the relative cost of mitigation versus adaptation. And it turns out that mitigation means changing our energy portfolio, changing the way we do things, changing the way we live and move and do a few bunch of things, this have some cost. However, the cost of adaptation is hundreds or maybe a thousand times more, because now we're talking about the cost of all the coastal real estate, including every coastal city, right? Now, I can imagine buying a condominium in Miami Beach. Maybe I can't afford it, but I could Think of it, right? And then buy the one next to it. Buy the entire floor. Now buy the next floor and the whole building. Now do the next condo and the next one and the next one. All of those now start on the cost of building the schools and the infrastructure and the roads and the electric company and everything else there is. What is the value of an entire city that's going to be gone within a century? This is a very difficult thing to estimate, but it's hugely more, just the real estate value. Never mind the disease vectors, the storm damage, and other things that are the impacts of climate change. So the adaptation is much more expensive than mitigation. So it's certainly worth doing something about. So the five questions, yes, climate is changing. Yes, we're responsible. Yes, it is bad. Yes, we can still do something about it. And yes, it's worth doing something about.
Very good. One through five from Dr. Sahagian. So let's talk about the term sustainability.
Oh, we've heard that a lot, haven't we?
We have. What does that mean for you?
Everybody wants to appear sustainable. And what does that mean? Well, the UN Brundtland Commission way back in 1987 or so decided that sustainability is fulfilling our needs in such a way that future generations can fulfill their own needs. And that's very laudable. Sounds good.
Right.
Sounds great until you realize that we're cheating a lot. Well, because our needs are vast. We need to burn fossil fuels. We need to drive big SUVs and pickup trucks. We need to have a lot of children. We need to eat a lot of meat. We need to waste a lot of stuff, right? We need to do all those things. We need these things, right? Now, future generations, though, they'll have very meager needs.
We don't need these things. We want these things.
Yeah, well, we think we need them, and future generations are going to need less. We've decided. So that's not quite fair, I would say. There's an intergenerational inequity there. I would define sustainability a little bit more strictly. You know, doing what could be done by everybody forever without impacting negatively the environment and the resources or depleting the things that people need to keep doing it forever.
Okay.
And that's much more stringent.
Yes, and much more difficult to attain, huh? Because for me to come to the radio studio today, I needed to have a gasoline-driven car that I drove over here. And when I think about going out to the West Coast to visit family, I'm getting on an airplane, and that's a lot going into the atmosphere. And I just am very negative on the idea that people are going to be willing to give up these things.
Yeah, I think you're right. We have not seen them willing to give up these things. I mean, it may be that we can transition to more electric transportation systems, electric cars, but that's only useful as long as the electricity comes from sustainable energy sources, such as solar, wind, hydroelectric, and arguably nuclear.
And that's a great point, because I think John Q. Public out there thinks if we go to all electric cars, and I think many people want to do that, including me, that we just think that the electricity is sort of free and we don't think about the source of the electricity.
Yeah, and so, you have to consider the source. And right now, we need to hugely increase the sustainable energy sources because it's very hard to compete with the flash-in-the-pan energy available from burning fossil fuels when you have to use basically solar energy and the impacts of solar energy in real time, rather than having geologic processes concentrate that over 100 million years. It's hard to compete with that. However, that will last for another several billion years, as opposed to fossil fuels. They'll run out much sooner than that.
Why is the train your favorite mode of transport?
Oh, trains are great. Well, I mean, they can be electric, first of all.
Are you just a train buff from way back?
Yeah, I had electric trains when I was a little kid. Yeah, sure. You know, I like them. And trains are great because you get to relax, somebody else gets to do the driving.
That's right.
But they're big enough that you can move around, you can do stuff, you can do your work, you can relax, you can go have a meal, and you can get where you're going and take plenty of stuff with you if you need to, as opposed to a diesel-powered bus or a car, which is a one person, one vehicle burning a lot of fossil fuel.
Right. Dr. Sahagian, tell us some of your experiences talking to lawmakers about all these problems.
Oh, goodness. Well, that's always difficult for scientists, and we've been notoriously bad about doing that in terms that they understand and appreciate in general. So at the federal level, I was in Congress trying to impress upon the science advisor of one of our Pennsylvania Congress people the importance of climate change mitigation legislation. Great. So we should do something to reduce our emissions, et cetera. So this young science advisor suggested, well, why don't we just put scrubbers on the, you know, tailpipes of cars like we do on power plants? I said, well, you know, and I had a couple of graduate students with me, and they were like kind of taken aback by that. And I said, well, we kind of do that. We call them catalytic converters. They stop the nitrogen and sulfur oxides from getting out, and they cause acid rain, but the carbon dioxide still, of course, escapes into the atmosphere. And so this science advisor said, but if we stop emitting carbon dioxide, then all the plants will die, and we need them for food crops. Oh. And my graduate students were very well behaved. They did not fall laughing on the floor. I had to explain that, no, the plants are fine without our anthropogenic CO2. They don't need that. So that was, when we get an experience like that in Congress, the scary part was not that this science advisor was ignorant. The scary part is that one of our congressmen chose this person as a science advisor, shows the importance of science. So that was an eye-opener. And there are many other examples like this where there's a disconnect between the political process and scientific reality.
Oh, yes. How about pros and cons of nuclear energy? Some say it's the way of the future, and others are fearful.
Well, you know, was it Winston Churchill said that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself? Indeed.
That was FDR.
Was it FDR?
Yes.
Oh, all we have to fear is fear itself. I'm blown up on my history in any case. So, indeed, nuclear energy, the way it's done now, is fission of large fissionable nuclei such as uranium. They break up into daughters that are themselves unstable and radioactive, and that's the nuclear waste. And there's more efficient ways of dealing with it than we do, but then you have to take that waste and put it somewhere for a long, long time. These half-lives could be tens of thousands of years. Nuclear fusion, on the other hand, which we're just beginning to get a handle on, does not have these radioactive products and would be much more efficient once we can get that technology going. And these are, you know, fossil-free, meaning no carbon being emitted, no change in climate.
So you are a pro as far as...
Pro as long as we do it right. Okay. We have to do it right and not have Fukushima disasters.
Yes, indeed.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, believe it or not, our time is up. So, Dr. Dork Sahagian, thank you so much for coming over to WDIY to help us understand what's happening with our Earth. So this is all we have for Perspectives at this time. I'm John Pierce, your host. Until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.
If you enjoyed this program, please go to the WDIY website or app to share or become a WDIY member.